This is May 10th, 2015, Mother's Day. And I'm going to read kind of a light article called How a Skeptical Anchorman Became a Buddhist. And this is by Dan Harris, who wrote a book some of you have read.
10% Happier.
Yes, 10% Happier. This article of his appears to be from a online site called Nature Facts. Well, I don't know, Instagram and Twitter, whatever the hell those are. So he's the author of the book 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works, A True Story. It's about the longest subtitle I've ever heard. So he's an anchor for ABC News. And he starts off, if you had told me recently as a few years ago, that I'd ever become a Buddhist, never mind that I might even admit to it publicly, I would have coughed my beer up through my nose. I was raised by secular scientists in the People's Republic of Massachusetts. Paren, I did have a bar mitzvah, but only for the money. I've spent my career as a proud skeptic. My favorite part of being a journalist is the right, the obligation really, to doubt everything and everyone. And yet, here I am, a Buddhist. This declaration means both less and more than you might think. Less because Buddhism is not really a faith, at least not as I understand or practice it, and more because the version of Buddhism I've embraced is something that could be useful to millions of skeptical people who might otherwise reflectively reject it. Maybe even you. First, let me take issue with his statement, Buddhism is not really a faith. Well, in a really broad sense, we wouldn't be doing Zen practice unless we had some faith that it would work. We wouldn't exercise unless we had some faith that it's good for us. We wouldn't be restrained in what we eat unless we had faith that there's a good effect from that. But even leaving that aside, that sort of obvious kind of faith, I would say that Buddhism, in order to practice it, or even practice Zen, really, it implies a faith that there is something we can know that goes beyond what we can access, what we can apprehend through our ordinary mind, our discriminating mind, our analytical mind. There is something that we can grow into, something we can apprehend that is beyond the reach of our ordinary senses, sense perceptions, and our thinking mind, our discriminating mind. Now, not everyone may realize that that faith is at the base of their practice. I don't know, maybe it isn't. Maybe people who sit just to have their minds settle, you don't need to have faith to do that, other than what I mentioned about having some faith in the effectiveness of the practice. Roshi Kapalois used to say, there's only one faith in Zen means having faith that when the Buddha said, after his great enlightenment, that what we all have in common is this enlightened nature, of compassion and wisdom and virtue, this intrinsically enlightened nature. Faith means having faith that he was neither lying nor mistaken. But you can practice Zen without that faith. You can practice Zen without having a single thought about the Buddha. But we'll get more into that. So then he tells his story. He calls it his on-air Waterloo. It all started with a panic attack on national television. In 2004, I was filling in on a show called Good Morning America. And his job that morning was to read a series of short stories off the teleprompter. And then suddenly he was overtaken by an overwhelming bolt of fear. His heart was racing, his palms were sweating, his mouth dried up, and his lungs seized. He couldn't speak. And he had to bail right in the middle by, he says, breathlessly tossing it back to the main anchors of the show. To say the least, it was pretty embarrassing. Well, this drove him to see a psychotherapist of some kind, and one of the therapist's questions was, "Do you do drugs?" And he rather sheepishly said, "Yes, I do." At which point the therapist leaned back in his chair and said, "Okay, moron, mystery solved." And then he goes into the backstory, as he calls it, where he had been a young reporter eager to cover foreign conflicts, and he spent years in places like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Israel, Palestine, and Iraq. And after years of doing that, he came home and sank into depression. He said he didn't know he was depressed. That's not so uncommon, especially for men. He didn't know he was depressed. Began, even though he was exhibiting, he had been exhibiting some of the telltale signs, trouble getting out of bed, felt like he had a constant low-grade fever. And then this had caused him to make what he called a toweringly stupid move. He began to self-medicate with recreational drugs, including cocaine and ecstasy. He says that this drug use was sporadic and short-lived, but it was enough to artificially raise the level of adrenaline in his brain and prime him to have a panic attack. So, after this initial therapy session, he said he knew he needed to make some changes, and so right away he stopped doing drugs and he agreed to continue to see this shrink once or twice a week indefinitely. Then he says, "This is not a clean, tidy little story, however. It's not like I quit drugs, became a Buddhist, and my life immediately became a non-stop parade of rainbows and unicorns. Something totally unforeseen had to happen first." I'll paraphrase here. He got an assignment from his boss, the Peter Jennings, another ABC anchorman, that he would have to start covering faith and spirituality for ABC. "I tried to explain that I was at best an agnostic and therefore not the right guy for the job, but Jennings insisted, and so he spent the ensuing years visiting mosques, mega churches, and Mormon temples. But he said none of the material he encountered during this time spoke to him personally. That changed in 2008 when a producer with whom I worked recommended that I read a book by a self-help guru named Eckhart Tolle. I had never heard of the guy, unlike most people in this room, I'm sure many people have heard of him. I had never heard of the guy, but my colleague explained that Tola had sold many millions of books, was beloved by celebrities, Oprah especially, and that he might make for a good story. At first I thought Tola's book was irredeemable garbage. It was filled with pseudo-scientific assertions, weird language about vibrational fields, and grandiose claims about how his writings would provoke a, quote, spiritual awakening for you, the reader. Just when I was about to throw the book away, though, Tola began to unfurl a fascinating thesis about the human condition, one that I had never heard before. Tola's argument is that we all have a voice in our head, by which he is not referring to schizophrenia or hearing voices. He's talking about your inner narrator, the voice that chases you out of bed in the morning and yammers at you all day long. It has you constantly comparing yourself to other people, engaging in ruthless self-criticism, and casting forward into the future or ruminating about the past, to the detriment of whatever is happening right now. This is what I've and some other teachers have referred to sometimes as the inner critical voice that we Americans seem to be afflicted with more than other people, certainly more than Asians. The fault-finding voice in our heads, finding fault with ourselves and then by extension finding fault with others, but especially finding fault with ourselves. He goes on, when you're unaware of this non-stop conversation you're having with yourself, it yanks you around. It's what has you putting your hand in the fridge when you're not hungry, checking your email when your kids are trying to talk to you, or losing your temper when it's strategically unwise. This was a huge aha moment for me. I quickly realized that this voice Tola was describing was responsible for all of the things I was most ashamed of in my life, such as heedlessly going to war zones, getting depressed without even knowing it, and then blindly self-medicating. So somehow, the way that Tola framed it, the way that he worded this, was just right for this reporter. For others, it's other teachers. For some, it's, of course, the Buddha himself. It's other masters and other teachers. So much of this matter of spiritual practice and aspiration is hearing the words, the right words at the right time. And by right, it just means that the words that fit for each one of us as an individual. Two people can hear a great statement by the Buddha, and one can be moved by it, and another person not. And the same thing can be so for other teachers. This speaks to the law of dependent co-arising. It's sort of one of the core, most profound aspects of Buddhist doctrine, which is it's not just the teacher and her abilities or lack of abilities. It's not just the student and her abilities or lack of abilities. It's that particular teacher with that particular student at that particular time. So the notion of a better teacher is a kind of a false one. It's an abstraction that there's a teacher in some generalized way is better. It's the fit of the teacher with the student and vice versa. And that's not to say there's only one teacher for each student. Just, it's the same as that. I used to think when I was young that there was one woman out there who was the perfect match for me. And, God, how would I find her? She might live in Uruguay or Alaska or how would we ever find each other? But it's not, it doesn't work that way. It's like they say about mothers. Actually, I didn't even plan that. This is Mother's Day. that to be a good enough mother, and we could say the same, but a good enough teacher, that it works for a student. So for him, it was just the time. It worked just right. Hearing Tola's way of expressing this, we could say that what Tola was just saying in different words is the Dharma. And I think a lot of people have come to Zen and to Buddhism more broadly from having heard Eckhart Tolle. I get asked about him all the time. I do think he's a sincere guy who's probably, as well as you can tell from a distance, that he's probably had some kind of awakening experience, and he doesn't seem to have the need for celebrity. Well, he is quite a celebrity, but he doesn't seem to have the need for power. He doesn't seem to misuse his power of celebrity the way a lot of others might. So I respect him, as little I know about him, but he's basically teaching the Dharma in other words, in different words. And then Harris continues. But there was a problem. Tola didn't seem to offer much in the way of practical advice for dealing with a voice in the head. So this is my only quarrel with Tola, is he speaks of, in generalities, of what very well can be the truth, the nature of reality, but offers little in the way of practical advice of how to get people there. What happened to him, from what little I remember, was he was in a deep depression, and then he had a kind of spontaneous awakening, and that's exceedingly rare. That might be one of the reasons he is so popular, is that people cling to the hope that they might also have a spontaneous awakening. But no one should ever count on that. It's much more likely that if you set your feet on this path and adopt this method, that you'll then have that experience, not just by going to talks where people describe their own experience. I went and interviewed the guy, and when I asked him point blank for practical advice, he took a beat and said, "Take one conscious breath." At which point, the voice in my head was saying, "What is this strange little man talking about?" Not knowing what else to do, I ventured deeper into America's self-help subculture, where I met a gaggle of celebrity swamis who promise that you can solve all of your problems through the power of positive thinking. Which, sorry to break it to you, ain't gonna happen. I gave a teisho on this idea, this fairly positive thing in this country and some other countries about positive thinking. I also am very skeptical of it, that it would. I'm skeptical of it as a long-term approach or strategy to reaching real peace of mind. It can work for a while. You can sort of talk yourself into positivity, but the research shows that it's not a viable long-term approach. The only people I know who've had all of their problems solved through this kind of philosophy are the people who write those books. I was at wit's end. But then my fiancé and now wife, Bianca, swooped in for the save. She gave me a book by Dr. Mark Epstein, a shrink from New York, who writes about the overlap between psychology and Buddhism. As I read Epstein's book, I had another big aha moment. I realized that the smartest material from Tola was basically Buddhism. He continues, despite ostensibly being a religion reporter, my only prior exposure to Buddhism was when, as a 15-year-old punk kid, I stole a Buddha statue from a local gardening store and put it in my bedroom because I thought it looked cool. I had no idea that 2,500 years before Eckhart Tolle started cashing his royalty checks, it was the Buddha, heretofore known to me only as a lawn ornament, who was talking about the voice in the head. Just a little sidebar here. There are many in Buddhism who would say that it was his karmic affinity with the Dharma that was partly responsible for his ending up with that lawn ornament in his room. Not that stealing would ever be excused, but that it was, let's just put it this way, it was no accident that it was a Buddha that he stole. And then he says the Buddha used a different term, monkey mind. We're like furry little primates, he said, swinging through a jungle of thoughts, urges, and desires, always clinging to things that won't last, and constantly lurching from one pleasant experience to the next, never fully satisfied. Think about it. How many great meals, movies, and social encounters have you experienced over the course of your lifetime? And are you done? Of course not. We're insatiable. The pursuit of happiness becomes the source of our unhappiness. Well, this is, some people fasten on this, seeing desire as the source of suffering, and are stymied by it. How can we live without desire? Just to eat requires some desire for food, some hunger. And there are a lot of other similar things. But it's clear to understand that, and it's important to understand that desire is, it's not a very useful word, desire. There's so many kinds of desires. There are base desires, just the desire to be famous or desire to have money or desire to be more successful than others. These are the desires that become inflamed by getting too involved in social media like Facebook. And then there are more exalted desires, such as the desire to come to awakening for the sake of others. That's a desire, you could say. But the difference between the two is that in the first case, the baser desires, they're more like grasping at something that we think is apart from us, something out there that we want to secure for ourselves and hang on to. This is also what you could call clinging, grasping and then clinging. And this does inevitably breed suffering. But the desire to do something is something entirely different. Yeah. So at the end of every sitting, we recite what we call the four bodhisattva vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate. Okay, you want to call it a desire? Sure, it is, in a way. But it's the aspiration, is that probably a better word? The aspiration to awaken for the sake of others, not just as to sort of reach out and try to grasp something that we think is outside us and never has been, by the way, for our own, out of our own self-interest. This is, I think, what can be so misleading about Theravadan Buddhism. For those of you who don't know, there are two main streams of Buddhism. One is the Mahayana, that's us, we're part of that, and the other is the Theravada, which has many wonderful things about it. It's more based on the earliest teachings of the Buddha. But in Theravadan Buddhism, there is such a strong emphasis on eradicating desire, which for someone who is more seasoned practitioner, they know the difference between base desires and the aspiration to do something for others' sake, but too easily becomes misunderstood as you're bad. This just feeds the American inner critical voice, is with our cravings to think that we're bad as long as we have desires for any kind of sense pleasures. In Zen, we talk less about desire as the root problem and more about what gives rise to this craving, which is division in the mind, separating ourselves, imagining that there is an object out there separate from us as a subject that we have to somehow acquire. That division is what flames the desire. So we go to underneath desire as the cause, and as we said just this morning, a few minutes ago, the cause of our sorrow is ego delusion. It's delusion. Dividing self and other, dividing us and them, dividing this and that, dividing enlightenment and non-enlightenment. This is the root of it all. And then he continues, unlike Tola, the Buddha had actual actionable advice for taming the monkey. At this point, though, a fresh problem arose, because what he was recommending sounded horrible to me, meditation. I'd always assumed that meditation was only for people who live in yurts, are really into ultimate frisbee, and use the word namaste unironically. My attitude was aptly summed up by Alec Baldwin's character on the TV show 30 Rock, who said, meditation is a waste of time, like learning to speak French or kissing after sex. But then I heard about a recent explosion of scientific research into meditation. This research is still in its early stages, but it's strongly suggestive of an almost laughably long list of benefits. These include lowering your blood pressure, boosting your immune system, and effectively rewiring key parts of the brain for happiness, focus, emotional regulation, and compassion. We're going to see these studies confirming these benefits just pouring out more every year as time goes on, because it's true. These things, meditation works in these ways. Most of these things he ticks off here, blood pressure, immune system, and so forth, are focused on one's own benefit, one's own self-interest. But then in the end, he mentions compassion. That's the key in this, in terms of Buddhism. And the emphasis in the Mahayana, more than the Theravada, In the Mahayana, it is this emphasis on, yes, coming to awakening for the sake of others, in order to be able to better help others, to be more effective in serving others. This is the whole point. All of these other benefits to us as an individual are secondary, really, from a Mahayana perspective. They're great. Who wouldn't want to have lower blood pressure and stronger immune system and be happier and more focused and have more stabilized emotional life? But the key thing is the suffering of others as well as one's own suffering. Then I learned that meditation doesn't require you to sit in a funny position, light incense, or chant. There are no fees, nothing to join, no special outfits to wear. It's simple brain exercise. Well, I think if he keeps sitting, he'll see it in a less reductive way, in terms of, you know, just being a brain exercise. In Zen, we would say it's not the brain. It's more than that. It's beyond our brain functions. It's becoming whole, not being so centered in the prefrontal cortex, but rather responding with our whole bodies to circumstances and to others who need our response. Brain exercise doesn't begin to reach the promise of long meditation. I'm going to come back to this sitting in a funny position, lighting incense, chanting, and so forth. But first, let me... then he just gives the basic instructions for the meditation that he learned. He says your eyes can either be closed or not closed. In Zen, for hundreds of years, we've always recommended that the eyes be open, lowered. The head is straight. The eyes are open, but just sort of half open. They're looking down slightly. And this has advantages that all of you who've been to an introductory workshop would have heard, starting with keeping you more alert. As the light gets in on the retina of the eye, then it's easier to stay alert and not succumb to drowsiness. Just to pick out one, very brief. He has a very brief description of how to meditate here. So I won't. It's nothing. It's pretty much the same, but as anyone here knows. And they said, I kept at it, and pretty soon I started to see two big benefits. First, it boosted my ability to focus. The daily practice of trying to pay attention to my breath, getting lost, and then starting again, and again, and again, really helped me to stay on task at work, especially in this tech-saturated age that has been dubbed the Info Blitzkrieg. Okay, that's one of the obvious benefits anyone will find. Reducing stress, becoming more calm, developing concentration. These almost go without saying. The second benefit, and this is the biggie, is something called mindfulness. Ooh, that sounds pretty exotic. Don't be fooled by the blandness of the word. It's a game-changing proposition. Mindfulness is the ability to see what's happening in your mind at any given moment without getting carried away by it. I would just add to that, not just what's to see what's happening in your mind. Yeah, maybe that would be more the point when you're sitting in actual formal meditation, to see what's happening in the mind. But then sitting meditation is such a tiny fraction of the work of this practice. So it also means see what's happening around you. Noticing what's going on in your mind and what's going on around you. This is mindfulness. So he's, but right now he's focusing on probably the formal sitting meditation. Think about how useful and scalable mindfulness could be. Just as an example, you're driving down the road and someone cuts you off. What happens in your mind in that moment? Most likely you think to yourself, I'm angry. And then boom, you immediately and reflexively inhabit that thought. You actually become angry. Now here I have to take issue with this. I think he's wrong. I think that if someone cuts you off in traffic, you're not immediately thinking, I'm angry. That's the problem, is you're not aware of your anger because you're so focused on that other driver and what you'd like to do to that other driver and what you'd like to say to that other driver and so forth. You get obsessed with the object of the anger that you don't even know you're angry. You're not really aware of it. So the key thing when something or someone provokes you is to first of all notice that you're angry. Okay, I'm angry here. I'm angry there. In that self-awareness, a space opens up. A little space opens up in which we have a choice as to how to react. But if we're really angry, I'd submit, and this is based on my long experience with anger, I would submit that we become oblivious to our state, our own physical and mental state. We just want to kill that other person. And we're focused on that other person or that other car. But then he says, mindfulness helps you short-circuit that heretofore automatic, habitual, mindless reaction. See, there's the mindlessness. That's it. It's just not a lack of awareness. And then he says, if you're a meditator who gets cut off on the highway, you might notice, oh, my chest is buzzing, my ears are burning, I'm experiencing a starburst of angry thoughts, I'm getting angry. See, there it is. There, I agree, that the meditation enables you to notice the physiological signs of anger and otherwise notice that you're getting angry. But you won't necessarily have to bite the hook and chase the other driver down the road screaming expletives with your children in the back seat. Clearly, mindfulness, and then he says another term might be emotional intelligence. I wouldn't say not exactly. Anyway, mindfulness has a lot of applications in a work context, which is why meditation is now being adopted in some surprising places. Corporate giants such as Google, Aetna, Procter & Gamble, and General Mills are doing it. Elite athletes like the Seattle Seahawks and Novak Djokovic are getting involved. Even the U.S. Marines are meditating. And again, just to distinguish here from the Dharma as we know it, these are all ways in which the idea is that the goal would be to develop successful habits and self-mastery for one's own, either one's own benefits, one's out of one's own self-interest, or the interest of the corporation, or in the last case, the Marines. That doesn't begin to reach the aspiration of wanting to help others. When executives and warriors learn to meditate, they are not generally taught Buddhism per se, but instead a secularized version of Buddhist meditation known simply as mindfulness practice. This type of meditation, often taught in a form called mindfulness-based stress reduction, has exploded in popularity in recent years. Some Buddhist purists are upset about this trend. They call it McMindfulness. While I share some of their concerns, I largely disagree. I think stripping the Buddhist language out of practice makes it attractive to millions of people who don't want to be involved with religion or who fear being dragooned into abandoning their current religious beliefs. I would agree with them. I think it's this mindfulness stripped of any religious content is better than nothing. Sure, it's fine as far as it goes. It's a kind of settling for something far less than what we're capable of, but sure. He says, bottom line, more mindfulness is better than less mindfulness, even if I might quibble with how it is sometimes delivered. Then he goes on, Buddhists may have perfected this kind of meditation. No, there's no such thing as perfection in meditation. They may have perfected this kind of meditation, but mindfulness is an innate human capacity. After all, we are classified as Homo sapiens. And then he seems to define it in quotes as the one who thinks and knows he thinks. And now he gets into more familiar territory to many of us. Nevertheless, I still think it's kind of a shame that Buddhism is being de-emphasized for three reasons. First, what you get from Buddhism that you don't necessarily get from secular mindfulness is an ethical training that I have found to be personally useful. This is not talking preachy, finger-wagging stuff. The Buddha taught a series of practical steps that can actually make you nicer, and in a way that appeals directly to your self-interest. He knows he has to include that to get people to do this. Turns out it's harder to meditate when you're a jerk. The mind has trouble concentrating when you're fending off creeping remorse or struggling to keep your various lies straight. I can't help but wonder with these last couple sentences whether he might have seen an article I wrote for Tricycle very recently, right before he wrote this article, in which this is the point I make in almost the same words, is that if you just to be a better never mind a better person, just to be a better meditator, it pays to uphold the precepts, to lead an upright life, because otherwise you can find your meditation hindered by regrets, by guilt and remorse. And I use the example of lying. But then he continues, Buddhists aim to create a virtuous cycle. When you're nice to others, your meditation improves, which makes you happier and therefore nicer, and so on. So yes, he's dead on here about the ethical aspect being absent from this popular marketing of mindfulness. It's absolutely essential. As I say in this little article I wrote, there are three basic elements of Buddhist practice. Meditation, upholding the precepts or upholding ethical or moral conduct, and what's called wisdom, which it can be understood as enlightenment, and as well as other ways. So, huge, huge thing missing from a strictly secular mindfulness practice is the aspect of moral, upright moral conduct. Second, what is also lost when Buddhism is shunted to the sidelines is several millennia's worth of truly fascinating philosophy, as well as vital boots on the ground mental exploration. For 2,500 years, these people have been meticulously mapping the mind, exploring what makes us tick. They've come up with a system to wake you up to the clang and clatter of your own ego so that it doesn't control you. It's a mental exercise regime that cultivates positive traits such as self-awareness and compassion, and helps you better live in a universe characterized by impermanence and entropy. So this is where some people get off the bus and they just don't seem to put much stock in the fact that this is a teaching. It's not a religion in the sense of there being a god. The Buddha certainly didn't consider himself a god. But others will say, okay, this has been around for 2,500 years ago. It's been refined over the course of that time. It's been confirmed. It's passed the test of time. And there is a remarkable agreement among enlightened masters over the course of 2,500 years ago. So maybe I should give the benefit of the doubt to the fact that these masters, the Buddha himself, embraced this thing we call Buddhism, and that there is much more to it than just mindfulness. It is a much more full-bodied presentation of reality, and that's really what it is. Someone just in the 19th century, I think, someone who went to Asia, a missionary from England or the United States, they encountered the practice of the Dharma. That's what it was called, the Dharma. And he didn't know how to refer to it when he was writing home. So he saw them. He saw Buddha figures in these places. So he came up. He coined the phrase Buddhism. Buddhism. And that has stuck. But before that, it was in the various languages of Asia, it was just really called the Dharma, practicing the Dharma, which just means practicing the truth, being present. And so long as we are caught in the ism of Buddhism, then we are missing the point. Then the third one, which brings me to my third point, this religion, in quotes, is not, in my view, really a religion. As the writer Stephen Batchelor has said, Buddhism is not something to believe in, but something to do. Something to do, a practice. You don't have to believe in anything. It doesn't require a belief system. Newcomers who haven't seen the magnificent intelligence of about human nature and the world yet, those who haven't discovered this in Buddhist texts, can just leave the Buddhism out. But practice. And you'll find the truths, these ancient truths, being confirmed through your own practice. It's not something to believe in, but something to do. But he leaves out one extremely important other benefit, one advantage of embracing Buddhism. And that is, as a fourth point, is the whole teaching of enlightenment. You see this more and more ignored as the years go by in the West, and it's so distressing to see that it's being shunted off to the side because it is the most joyous experience a human being can have. And I'm afraid that more and more people are just seeing themselves as unable to experience it. It's a terrible, terrible selling oneself short. All right, then he goes on to say, I wanted to read one thing. People who will acknowledge the value of something that has been passed down over many centuries are people who will see the value of a path that has been established, a path that has been trod by thousands, maybe millions of others, and will trust the path. And I have this kind of a poem that is a beautiful metaphor for the path of Buddhist practice, including Zen. This is from by Lars Gustafsson, a Swede, And here's the English translation. Ballad of the Paths in Vestmanland. Under the visible script of small tracks, gravel tracks, forest tracks, often with a grass ridge in the middle, between deep ruts hidden beneath twigs heaped in clearings, still distinct in crumbling moss, another script runs. The old paths. They lead from lake to lake, from valley to valley. Sometimes deeper furrows, more distinct, and sturdy bridges of medieval stone carry them over black streams. Sometimes they evaporate on bare, rocky ground. You lose them easily in swamps, so imperceptibly that one moment they are there and the next not. They do go on. Always there's a going on. You only have to seek. The paths are obstinate. They know what they want, and with that knowledge they combine considerable cunning. You walk east. The compass points insistently east. Faithfully the path follows the compass like a streak. All is well. Then the path veers north. And north there's nothing. What does the path want? Soon comes an enormous moor, and the path knew it. It leads us around with the certainty of someone who knows what's what. It knows where the moor is. It knows where the hill is too steep. It knows what happens to someone who circles the lake to the north instead of south. It has done it all so many times before. That's the whole point of being a path. It came to be made long ago. And then he acknowledges that, he says, well, I'm clearly a big fan of Buddhism. I hasten to add that it definitely won't solve all of your problems. I've learned the hard way that it won't make you taller or regrow your hair, which is why I wrote a book about my experiences as a meditator and called it 10% Happier. He says, it sounds like a good return on investment. He says, after 6 years of meditating, I am far from enlightened. And then he says, if my wife were writing this article, she'd call it 90% still a moron. He's learned how to be self-deprecating and how that engages the reader. But mindfulness has dramatically cut down on my levels of useless rumination, mindless misbehavior, counterproductive crankiness, and general distractedness. It has made me a happier person, a more collegial colleague, and more appreciative of my beautiful wife and our baby son. I strongly believe that if I had learned how to meditate as a young reporter, I would have been able to have avoided the cascading stupidity that produced my on-air panic attack. If I can leave you with one thing, give meditation a shot, whether it's Buddhist meditation or secular mindfulness. As I like to say, if it can work for a fidgety, skeptical newsman, it can work for you. Or as one famous Buddhist monk once said, happiness is available. Please help yourself. We'll stop now and recite the four Bodhisattva vows.